Welcome to Cangria, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And what a week. What a week. First of all, I believe we owe some of our listeners an apology. We didn't put a show out last week. Now, I am pretty sure I notified the stations that carry us, but I don't think I got round all of them. So we may not have been able to reach everyone. And some folks may have heard us for a second time. Yeah, no, just odds were not in our favor getting a show together last week.
Well, I mean, there was travel that involved multiple time zones involved. So yeah, sometimes it's hard to get things together depending on what's going on.
Yeah, but I mean, 10 years of doing this, once in a blue moon, not too bad. All right, now it has also been one heck of a week in terms of gay news. Let's start off with, well, later on in the show, we have a great interview lined up with an academic who is looking into bisexual leadership. So we're actually going to leave that conversation for a little bit later in the show as we dive into the topic at large. When we come back, there's a little piece about contextualization of privilege that I think we should it'd be great if we can dive into that discussion as well.
And identity. Yeah.
Yeah. But before we get there, Toronto Pride was in the news, although I'm pretty sure they would like you to not know that.
Oh yes.
In fact, as an aside, I thought, oh wow, this is pretty serious. They had their AGM last week, give or take, on the 25th. Now, Pride Toronto, why should we care about this? They are the largest Pride organization in the country of Canada. They represent a lot of queer folks in Canada. When we think about the concentration of queer folks, disproportionately high in the mega cities like Toronto. And for the queer community, very important. They are the biggest. So from accountability, we keep an eye on them. So they had their AGM. And during that AGM, I don't know if this was discussed. We weren't invited to the AGM.
We weren't invited.
Yeah. But we will be looking in. And I thought, oh, this is fine. AGM, let's see if they post anything about it. They've got a beautiful new website. I really like their website. And they've got a drop-down menu item called News. And I'm like, oh, brilliant. Exactly what I'm looking for. Coming soon.
Coming soon, exactly.
Yeah, so it's now, about a week after their AGM. It's a couple of weeks since they announced, a couple of months since they announced the theme for Pride Toronto 2024, neither of which constitute news on their new website. So we will keep an eye out. But there is news about Pride Toronto, whether the website discloses this or not. And that is the fact that Pride Toronto, following very serious allegations of defrauding federal government grants, allegations we had, I'm blanking on his name.
Tom something. Tom.
Yes, I'll pull up his last name.
Professor Tom.
Yes, he is a historian, but the Pride Toronto certainly ruffled a lot of feathers. Now, some folks are thinking, okay, what happened? Like, why is this an issue at all? Now, Tom Hooper, found his name.
Hooper, there you go.
He's an assistant professor in the Department of Equity Studies at York. Said and came on our show. We did a great interview with him. Came on as said that Pride Toronto essentially lied, broadly speaking, essentially lied in grant applications to the federal government. Now, this included things such as saying, oh, these Indigenous organizations that a lot of people have a lot of respect for, they're on board with this plan.
Yes.
Fed organizations, no clue. The 519, the most respected queer organization, one of the most expected queer organizations in Toronto, they're fully on board with this plan. Also, no idea. They had essentially fake endorsements from organizations that carried a lot of weight and certainly would have helped them to land several of these grants.
Yeah. And
So, you know.
that's basically the story right there, was that in order to get a lot of these federal grants, you have to basically put together a package, a proposal that says that you're capable of satisfying the requirements that are associated with the price tag, and you get endorsements usually, and then you get the grant, and then later on you write up a report saying this is what we did with the money and this is how we were successful. And basically almost every single thing that they could fraud, they frauded. They made up letters of endorsement, they made up plans that they never really intended to follow. They made up a lot of stuff. And then they got called out on it. And that's the history. And the update,
Well,
the
we're not talking small change here.
whoa, no,
It
we're
was,
talking, yeah.
yeah, it was $600,000 from the Department of Canadian Heritage in 2019 for that Indigenous Two-Spirit Artwork Initiative, $1 million from Public Safety Canada in 2018 to look at community safety strategy. Now, if you can recall, we were flabbergasted that a national community safety initiative would come out of one local pride organization. And then they got 250,000 from Canadian Heritage again to build and develop bilingual tools. Now, after quite a kerfuffle and the ouster of the or the leaving of the previous executive director
Well,
of
it's also worth pointing out, by the way, that there was a condition associated with one of those requirements, that in the package where they improve security, what they were supposed to be doing is improving, helping to promote and improve relations between the community and the police. And it was supposed to be a nationwide thing. And they basically said, we're going to start by improving it in Toronto. And they had to let the Toronto police back into the parade. That was one of the conditions associated with that grant. And they just decided at the last minute not to. Now, a lot of people were saying, if you don't let the police in the parade, that's kind of your business. You know, you are the committee, you're the ones who get to choose who does and does not get to march. But then if you're not willing to let them march, don't say you are willing to let them march and then accept big money from the government. Like that's a lie, that's fraud.
Absolutely. Well, the Tom Hooper did attend the recent AGM, and it was during the AGM that Modeste, the current executive director at Toronto Pride, revealed that they are actually paying some of that money back. Now, he says under pre the previous, you know, under the under those other guys, under those the you know the people before, hang on, I can't speak to the past, but under those people. Frankly, lacked a lot of evidence. Now, KPMG did a review. It was not an audit. They did a review of Toronto Pride and found that when Toronto Pride had said, oh, we have delivered X, Y, and Z, they couldn't really find the evidence for X or Y and some for Z. That was essentially what Toronto Pride has said again. They were like, you know, our practices around providing reporting and so on was insufficient, and they could not prove that they had done the things that they were then paid by the government for doing, which has been called misdirection of funds, has been called, you know, I'm sure there are more serious allegations that can be attributed to that. But what seems to have been failed to be mentioned here is that the federal government wasn't just a bystander in this entire process. They didn't sit back and go, oh, well, it looks like Toronto Pride, which just fooled us out of, you know, a lot of money. They can figure this out. We trust them. They'll solve all of these problems. No, not at all. The Department of Canadian Heritage, which was behind at least two of the grants, conducted a participant audit. They did audit Toronto Pride, specifically around deliverables on these grants, at least one of the grants, and found that they were lacking, which is unsurprising. Now,
And to be fair to Toronto Pride, a lot of volunteer-based organizations and charity organizations overpromise and underdeliver. But the difference is that usually when they get audited, when people look into their practices, they found that even if they did a bad job, they did a job. You know, they may have taken on, they may have bitten off more than they could chew. They may have taken on a project that their organization is not ready for yet, but at least they did a thing. And some of the conditions that were associated with Toronto Pride's grant, there's no evidence that they even tried, which really does not look good.
No, absolutely not. Now, really, this brings a lot of shame on queer organizations, one of the biggest in the country, and is now, well, I mean, put frankly, this is the harshest financial penalty that any queer organization in Canada has ever had to pay, where they are now looking at paying back over $505,000. They've already forked over 100 grand on that to cover. Payment back to grants where deliverables weren't made, as well as the interest on that. Yeah, the federal government certainly took them to task. So this it's worth noting, this wasn't okay. Don't get me wrong, I am sure that the current leadership of Toronto Pride and the board of directors of Toronto Pride and the current staffing structure there, who clearly have nothing to do with anyone who was there previously, I'm sure they are trying their best. But this is an organization that frankly misled funders repeatedly. So there is a
Repeatedly.
serious issue there that needs to be dealt with. And they're now paying back, and they have another 420,000 still to go. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what kind of impact that has on the Pride Festival moving forward. It's ironic, really, that their theme is the right to be, and they're resisting and they're facing one of this really steep financial fine. So we'll see how it all unfolds. All right. Any other comments on Toronto Pride and where they're now forking over the cash?
Well, I mean, whether or not this reflects on LGBT organizations in Canada, I think it also might be a reflection on charity and not-for-profit organizations in Canada, because there you hear rumors about local organizations that are mismanaged, and I don't know, I would hate to see good organizations get swept up in sort of a massive audit, checking that all the organizations are above board, because audits are expensive. And you have to do them. If you're being audited, the people who are telling you to get audited, they're not paying for it. They're telling you, you need to pay for someone to audit you, or we're gonna have words. So I wouldn't want to see that happen. I don't know. It's really kind of unfortunate that it came to this, and what it could imply for either specifically LGBT organizations or just charity and nonprofit organizations in general. I hope it doesn't turn into anything.
Absolutely. All right. Just after this, we have our interview with Tarolyn as we discuss bisexual leadership in management. And before then, we've got Wasn't Easy by Becca Krokova, and we will be
It's
back
like my
just
trying
after
only set
this.
me back, and all of my dreams were slipping right through the cracks. It's like I'm searching for you in the mud. I'm digging holes only to watch them fill back up. And when the ocean pulls away from the shore, I spend the low tide trying to find what I'm searching for. And nothing seems to go my way. I see a train wreck coming and I can't escape. 'Cause it wasn't easy.
Just a
rather keep you in my hands, so I can hold you close and feel you again. But if holding means that we can't stand, I will release you and let this come to an end.
Welcome back to Canterbury, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we have not locked him in the broom closet for this interview, so we are very excited to have you your facial reaction to that. Well, normally I do these interviews solo, and I often would say that you're locked in the washroom, you're indisposed. But no, on this occasion, you are joined us. Now, I am very excited about the conversation because we have been sort of pottering around this topic in a few different weeks of the show. So I'm excited to have someone who's really diving deep into it. We don't have all the answers yet, but I think you've gathered up the questions, and that's half the battle. Tara-Lynn, why didn't you take a moment just to introduce yourself to our listeners and kind of frame what we're going to be talking about today?
Absolutely. And thank you, Luke and Sebastian, for having me. My name is Tara-Lynn Parr, and I'm currently pursuing my PhD at the Ontario Studies for Institute in Education at the University of Toronto. And my dissertation study is looking at how bisexuals disclose and navigate their sexual identities while they're in leadership positions in professional service organizations in Canada. And what really motivated me to look into this was that when I came out in the workplace, there were a number of experiences that left me feeling a little bit uneasy about how people were perceiving me. Some questions came up and comments related to my gender at the time, other things that made me feel sexualized. And I knew that there was this inherent opposition between how we think about leaders, who are inherently supposed to be kind of desexualized people, and a lot of the stereotypes and myths that surround bisexuality. And so I was kind of consumed with anxiety and fear that by being out as a bisexual, I might not be seen as credible, or I was being sexualized. Like I do when I want to know the answers to a question, I kind of dive into the books. And when I started looking into this, I realized that there really was not a lot of information out there about bisexuals' experiences in the workplace. Especially, which is surprising to me, especially given that bisexuals are actually the largest community under the LGBTQ umbrella, and there's the least amount of research. And what I did find was that bisexuals often have very unique experiences in the workplace as compared to their LGBT other people under the umbrella. They have the lowest wages as compared to any other group. They experience biphobia, which is obviously, you know, unique from other types of discrimination. And they do get a lot of feedback pertaining to their gender. And so I thought that this was something that was really worthy of further investigating. So my main questions that are driving me are primarily for people who are out in the workplace. And being out is kind of a continuum, and it's kind of always fluid and shifting. But how did you actually come out, and how did you share that, and who did you share it with? And then the other question is, how do you navigate that on a daily basis in relation to all these ideas that exist out there around leadership? Because sometimes, you know, what I see in some of the literature is that a lot of these ideas might seem conflicting, But we know that there are bisexual leaders out there just by virtue of the size of the community. But I'm not sure about you. But for me, I can think of a lot of gay and lesbian leaders, but it's a lot harder to think of bisexual leaders, which I think is slowly starting to change. But hopefully this research will also shed some light onto how we can make that an easier and better process for people.
I mean, I think the questions you raised were, when I saw this study posted by a friend of ours, I was very much pretty captivated. We love a study here at Camp Queer. If there's an academic study, we're going to dive into the, you know, the R score and really get our fingers into it. But I think that this, broadly, it touches on a lot of other areas and topics that I think that we've sort of been skirting around. You know, we discussed the census, and I'm glad you mentioned the number of bi folks earlier, because when we were talking about the census in Canada, as well as in the US and the UK, which have all of our pretty recent census data, the number of bi folks vastly outnumbers queer folks. And, you know, we even talked a couple of weeks about a study that alludes to the fact that it's bisexual men that carry on, on accounts of gay men and lesbians not being physically able to make children.
You know, it's, and there was a study that was released back in the autumn, and I was trying to look it up, but I cannot remember the title or what journal published it. But there was a study that was released back in the autumn showing that they focused on bisexual men because it's easier to focus a study than it is to make it broader. But they found that it was a non-overlapping group with gay men and straight men. And not just, I mean, obviously, you're talking about a third category, that's fine, but they're talking about a whole raft of different properties and measures and self-perceptions. And they just found that it was the old model of a continuum from, you know, gay through to bisexual to straight. It really does seem to be like three separate distinct categories that just have so much variation within the categories that they appear to overlap. And now, I don't know, there has been explosion in the past, maybe like 2 or 3 years, very, very recent, on bisexuality as a distinct category, and how we shouldn't just view them as spicy straights or as gay light, that there is a distinct category there with unique properties to them. And I don't know why it took so long. And I think in the end, I think they just did like a basic like high school math, like Tukey T test to just prove that they're a distinct category. And then they were like, look, the numbers are there. So there has been this recent shift in studying bisexuality as its own thing.
Yeah, there absolutely has.
Yeah,
for sure. It's interesting because often I think about, you know, the relationship between bisexual gay men and straight men or other genders. The reality is that heterosexuals and, you know, gay men, lesbians have a lot more in common with each other than with bisexuals. Mm-hmm. They're both mononormative sexual orientations, meaning they're only attracted to one gender, where, you know, bisexuals are much more fluid and attracted to multiple genders. And it is a very unique experience. And I think that in-betweenness and not being able to be put into one box is, you know, this is just my opinion, but what also kind of drives a lot of that biphobia and a lot of their unique experiences in the world that do make them distinct, because people always want to categorize, like our brains just want to do that to make sense of things. And, you know, with bisexuals, it's a lot of, you know, hear things like, oh, you're just confused. It's like, well, maybe it's not me that's actually confused. Maybe, you know, the fluidity and the non-binary nature of their sexual identity is what's confusing for other people. But yeah, that's definitely starting to become a much more common understanding that it is a very unique sexuality.
You mentioned earlier, and I believe this is probably the crux of the research that you're looking to do, you know, specifically the experience of bi folks, you know, within the workplace. And you mentioned something that really kind of piqued my interest. The thing that really kind of jumped out from what you were saying to me earlier is the idea of being, you know, just by virtue of being bisexual and then being out and then being overly sexualized within a workplace. You know, that must be incredibly difficult in terms of managing colleagues, in terms of managing workplace relationships with, you know, your co-workers. And more importantly, I think it'd be interesting if you could look at the perspective, and I'm not telling you how to do your study, but I personally would be very curious as to the dynamic that's presented by management. So by folks in the management position, because of course that relationship between employee and manager is different again. And it would be interesting to see how the sort of over-sexualization of by folks intertwines with that power dynamic. Maybe it's too niche and I need to, you know, sit back and see what comes out of it, but it certainly sparked my my interest.
No, it's a really good point. One of the criteria for participation in the study is actually that the person has to be in a middle management position, so manager, director, senior director, basically, that middle kind of area. And a big reason for that is because, especially, you know, today we're seeing a lot of diversity and EDI initiatives. And part of a middle manager's job is to implement strategy, and EDI and diversity is a strategic kind of vision for a lot of organizations. And so I am interested in that relationship, because the middle manager reports up and then has people reporting to them. So they're actually in a very interesting position when it comes to power relations, because they kind of have to be everyone to everything. And so how do you manage that sexual identity in the context of all of these different relationships, all of these different power dynamics? And within professional service firms, that's even more complicated, because a lot of times you have owners of the business who you also have a very unique type of relationship to. And the sexualization is certainly a big thing. But the other thing that also comes up is, you know, I myself experienced this, and I know from the research that I'm not the only one, but a lot of bi erasure takes place. So, you know, people, you might come out to someone and they might say something like, oh, so, you know, you're halfway on your way to gay, or, oh, I believe that you might be bi, but I had someone tell me once that, you know, they don't believe that bisexual men exist. And so actually hearing a lot of this feedback, you know, in relation to your own sexual identity, contributes to kind of, again, thinking about, like, how are other people perceiving me? How am I experiencing myself in this work environment?
That really reminds me. I was hanging out with a friend of mine, and I genuinely forgot that he was bisexual. You know, because he's in a heteronormative relationship. Actually, I have a couple of friends who are identified bisexual in heteronormative relationships, i.e. straight relationships. But, you know, I think for queer folks, for gay folks, it is very self-evident when you're in a gay relationship. You know, that's certainly there. I'm wondering then about that, you know, bi folks have suffered not just bi erasure from the and fetishization from the straight community, but also a degree of eminosity and exclusion from queer folks as well. You know, that's stresses from both sides. And I bring it up because, like, I myself genuinely forgot I knew my friend's sexual identity and was momentarily surprised. So, you know,
sometimes
I know
I forget your partner's Vietnamese. Like, so, sometimes things just slip your mind because you just know them.
Yeah. And we usually kind of defer to the gender of someone's partner as an indication of their sexual identity. That's kind of the norm in terms of, you know, how we make those, how we remember or what have you. But obviously with bi people, that's not a very reliable indicator of their sexual identity. And it's interesting that you brought up the point around the animosity from, you know, the